scripture reading for this morning will be 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 through 21. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but it is God's power to us who are being saved. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and I will set aside the understanding of the experts. Where is the philosopher? Where is the scholar? Where is the debater of this age? Hasn't God made the world's wisdom foolish? For since, in God's wisdom, the world did not know God through wisdom, God was pleased to save those who believe through the foolishness of the message preached.
Good morning. We're continuing our series on dying, on the reality of human mortality and what the gospel has to say about that, whether soon or late or whenever, expected or unexpected. Human mortality is a fact that every person has to have a thought about. Even if you decide, I don't want to think about it, that's your thought about death. Everybody's got to think something about that reality of who we are. And it's good news for us that the gospel actually has quite a lot to say about it. So 2 weeks ago, we talked about the good news of death coming from 1 Peter chapter 3 and how the gospel message is centered around the dying Christ and how his story of triumph over death is the good news the gospel gives us about death. Last week, we talked about God as he connects to death and what is his role in that. Is he a God of death and dying? No, he's a God of life. He is one we might call the enemy of death, and he's going to win. This week, we get to what I might style the philosophical heart of the matter, the why bother of it all, the who cares of it all, comes out of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and we'll spend most of our lesson there beginning here in just a moment. But what Paul is going to do in this passage is to highlight to a very philosophical culture, the Greek Corinthian culture, to highlight to them why it was so essential to think this through in the terms of the gospel by showing them that every other way they had thought about mortality had come to nothing. Some people, I think, misread this passage. They think Paul is anti-philosophy. I think quite the opposite. I think he's doing some very serious philosophy here. He's just not doing that kind of philosophy, the philosophy of silly human speculation. No, he's engaging in what should we think if the gospel is true? That's his style of philosophy. And he comes to that very directly in our text. To warm you up to the idea that we need to talk about it, though, I thought I would highlight the fact that we in our own age have our own thoughts about the reality of death and what to do with it. And to show you how, you know, hip and trendy I am in my references, this is a book from 1957, so I mean really just cutting edge philosophy here. Now it's an old classic text that I had in my library written by Bertrand Russell, and the title of the book is Why I Am Not a Christian. And he's trying to explain how to live a life without God. Well, guess what? If you're going to ask that question, eventually, Mr. Russell, you've got to say something about death. And so he has a chapter in there, a little essay, titled The Worship of a Free Man, right? He's free from the shackles of God. He does whatever he wants. But he's got to have something to say about death. And he has this paragraph that is the most depressing paragraph ever constructed in the English language. I don't know if there's anything worse than this. And he sets it forward as if, this is the way it is. Isn't that great? But when you read it, you think, oh, I just want to go home and take a nap now. This is just terrible and depressing stuff. I'll give you just the last half of it. He's talking, well, if I can turn my clicker on. There we go. He's talking about the sadness of the universe that's dying and what will certainly come of it. And he says, there's no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling that can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruin. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute,
are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Merry Christmas. There you go. I mean, that's a cheery thought, right? What do you have to say about human life when you started out your book titled, Why I'm Not a Christian? Reasons Why I Don't Believe in God. You've got to say something about it. And one of the few options you have left is just to embrace despair and say, I like it. That's the way it's supposed to be. And to try to convince people that you're okay with that. Only on the foundation of unyielding despair can life have any meaning. Wow. But I appreciate his honesty, don't you? Because he's absolutely right. In a world without God, that is exactly the face of things that we have tried to avoid. And I know it's true because the Bible says it. We've been doing lessons, devotions from the book of Ecclesiastes on Sunday night. Can I read you a portion of Ecclesiastes chapter 2? That will sound a lot like what Bertrand Russell says, only just from a different point of view. This from Ecclesiastes 2. Well, I just ran right off the screen, didn't it? That's interesting. Let me just turn over there so I can get that first line. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, 13 and following. Says, then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, the fool walks in darkness, and yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies, just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and a striving after wind. This is Solomon's Bertrand Russell phase. The book of Ecclesiastes is him kind of passing through different motions of his life, trying to understand what life was about. And there was some time in there in the middle where he tried to figure things out without his God. And he records those reflections in the book of Ecclesiastes for you to ponder. And what he says is true in the sense that it's what he truly believed to be true in those moments. Doesn't that sound a little bit like Bertrand Russell's unyielding despair? He says, I was wise, I was very wise, but it finally occurred to me that no matter how wise I got, I would be dead. And they would put me in a hole in the ground next to the dumbest person who ever lived. And we'd be both just as dead. So what did it matter that all this human achievement and philosophy and wisdom that he had built up and amassed, what did it matter? In a world that didn't have something to say about death, he realized it didn't really matter very much. That, I believe, is exactly where Paul is picking up in our text in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 18. He's saying, good news. We finally have something worth saying about death. We don't have to cringe every time we hear about death anymore, because finally we have something worth hearing about. Here we come to 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 18, and he starts out like this. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. He describes the gospel message they're preaching as the word of the cross. The cross is at the very center of Paul's teaching. The death, the burial, and ultimately the resurrection of Jesus. But we start with his death. That hideous and heinous death on a cross, a death of pain, of agony, and of shame, but above all else, of death, of actual human death. He says, we preach that. We preach that and we call it good news. A story about a man dying on a cross is called gospel, euangelion, good news. He says, to a world that has nothing but fear of the grave, all you can say about that is, Paul, that's crazy talk. That is folly. You are serving a dead man. and you'll die like him. And he looks at all the accounts of living and dying in the world that he lived in, and he could say the same thing about ours. And he says that for each of these, the word of the cross is folly to a world that has given up and been defeated by death. But for those of us who believe in the gospel message and the good news he is proclaiming, that God is the enemy of death, that God is conquering death in Jesus Christ, that story of a crucified man is the greatest news of them all. We see it differently because it changes how we see everything. In verse 19, he quotes from the Old Testament. This comes out of Isaiah chapter 29, 13 and 14. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. What's he doing with this passage? If you were to go back to Isaiah and read this passage in its context, it's not necessarily talking about death as such. In its context, it's talking about political intrigue. In Isaiah's day, Israel was in a pickle. They were a small nation surrounded by much more powerful nations. Judah was outnumbered and outgunned, and they looked a lot like a pawn in a world of superpowers. Okay? In world geography, they weren't the United States. They were Belgium, right? They were a small player in a very big stage. And the superpowers were going back and forth over them, and they don't know what to do. So the hierarchy of Israel's government says, well, we need to make some deals. We need to make some compromises. We need to find a way to survive this. And Isaiah keeps telling them, no, you don't. Because no matter how powerful Assyria is, or Egypt is, or Babylon becomes, or Persia in years on by, years still to come, no matter how powerful anybody else is, the Lord your God, who is on your side, is more powerful still. And if you will be faithful to him, there is triumph against all odds. And one of the ways he says it is, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. What is Isaiah trying to say? Somewhere in a room, in every government headquarters on earth, there's a bunch of really smart guys. And they sit and they plot and they scheme. Because that's what they do. That's what we pay them for, right? The governments do that. They have guys in a room and they come up with what we call policy. Right? And they come out with, here's how our economy is going to work to make it best for everybody, or at least for us. And here's how our military is going to act. And here's how we're going to relate to other countries. And they come up with strategies to try to survive. And Isaiah says, meh, take it or leave it. He says, all of those strategies come to nothing because there's only one strategy that matters. Are you faithful to God or not? That's the winning strategy. All the wisdom of the wise perishes in the face of that one truth. Faithfulness to God is victory. What Paul is doing is taking that passage and now applying it not to the debate about what to do as a nation or a country. He's applying it to the individual struggle with life and death. And he says, don't you know the same thing is true? That God is going to take the wisdom of the wise. That in every place in the land today, there are people saying, here's how to live your best life. That's the title of the book by Joel Osteen. Live your best life now, right? Here's how to live your best life and get the best out of it. Here's how to make the most of it. Here's how to face the fact that you will someday die or to ignore it. Here's how to make some sense out of your life. And boy, they sound smart. They sell a lot of books. They make a lot of television interviews showing us how clever they are in answering the question of how best to live your life. And Paul says, meh. Take it or leave it. He says, none of it's that impressive in comparison to the doctrine of the faithfulness of God. God is going to take every grand idea we've ever had and turn it upside down. Because God is going to do what none of them could actually do. When you ask people how to live your life, all of them can tell you how to live your life in view of the fact that you will die. None of them can tell you what to do about dying. Someone can say, you only live once, so get the most you can out of it. But they can't keep you from dying. Somebody can say, you're going to die, And so be sad and miserable about it all the days of your life. But they can't keep you from dying. They can say, you're not going to die. You're going to live forever. And they can't keep you from dying. They can distract you and change the topic, but they can't keep you from dying. God and God alone has an answer to the reality of that question that every human enterprise fails to provide. It's the wonderful works of God that will confound unbelieving human wisdom. And so in verse 20, he says, what has anything else ever amounted to? Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Where is the wisdom of this age? What's he saying? He says, take a look around. In Greek philosophy, you had some Stoics, and you had some Epicureans, and you had some of these and some of those, and you had some Platonists, and you had all the different philosophical schools, and in Corinth, they had every one of them. And he says, how's that working out for them? Socrates, wisest of men. You know what happened at the end of his life? He died, and he had no answer for that. Plato, student of Socrates, wisest of the wisest of men. You know what happened at the end of his life? He died, and he had nothing to say about that. He says, look around at our answers, and I would challenge you to do the same thing. Look at the lies we live by in our culture. Cynicism. We laugh at it. Anybody who tries to get us to take something seriously, we turn it into a joke. Cynicism is a way to avoid death. Executioners say there's a funny thing that happens when people take the scaffold. He says that sometimes they'll call it the guillotine smile. That when you reach that last moment and you have that utter despair, you tell a joke. He says some people just find comfort in that last moment in telling a joke about dying. You ever think that maybe that's what humanity loves to do? We love a little cynicism. You start getting a conversation going with me that's actually serious, that actually might have consequences for my life, and I'm going to tell a joke. This is getting uncomfortable. I once picked up a young man at a crisis center. He had threatened to take his own life and been turned into the crisis center where they kept him for a week and had talked about his life and his setting and what had led to him thinking about ending his own life. And I picked him up, and it was a 3-hour drive back to where his home was. And my plan was pretty simple. My thought was, whatever was going on there led you to here, so let's not go back there. So my thought was, I've got a captive audience. He needs a ride, and I've got a car, and I get 3 hours to talk about whatever I want. So I kind of warm up the conversation a little bit. We talk about trivial nonsense. And then I say, let me talk to you a little bit about what you're going through and how we got here. And he says, hey, just given where I just came from, I can tell you serious stuff is the last thing I want to talk about. And you understand what he means, but what was he doing? He was defending himself from having to have a tough conversation about where he had been and where he was headed. He was going to take this car ride back to the same place around the same people and the same influences that had led him to the brink of death, and he had no answer for it. And his solution was cynicism. I'd rather laugh at it and tell a joke and talk about trivial nonsense than actually deal with the question that I had that led me here to begin with. And we have so many brands of that. Fatalism. Well, we're all going to die, and you're going to die when you die, so just don't worry about it. I've heard that from people so many times. Well, eventually you're going to die. We all got a day coming. It's going to happen, so it just happens, and I don't worry about it. Well, that's great. How's that working out for you? Nihilism. Go read some French philosophers. Better yet, don't read any French philosophers. They're terrible. And they'll tell you, you're all going to die, and nothing matters, and they're great fans of Bertrand Russell. Unyielding despair. But what our culture is best at is escapism. Change the subject. There's a book written a decade or so ago called Amused to Death, The Story of American Culture. Amused to Death. That our biggest strength in American culture is changing the topic. We don't want to talk about real stuff. We don't want to talk about things that actually matter. We don't want to have real conversations about my life and where it's going. So let's talk about what reality show was on last night and who's going to survive through the finale to next season. Let's talk about what's going on. Even our politicians are complacent in this, that they provide us, you know, like, 24-hour cycle of nonsense to talk about. Our celebrities have done it. Everybody participates. I like sports, but our sports have done it, right? Why do we get so passionate about these things that don't matter? Because they keep me from thinking about things that matter. Because I don't have an answer for that question yet, and I just don't want to talk about it. Paul says, where's the debater of this age? Where's the scribe? Where's the wise man? Where have they gotten us? Have they advanced human civilization? Or have they just distracted us to death? Paul says, don't you think it's about time to have a real conversation about what matters? And folks, that's what the gospel does. That's why it is both beautiful and terrifying to the same people. Because it forces you for a moment to think about something that actually matters in your life. He describes it in verse 21 like this. For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. Through the folly of preaching. What is he describing? He says God recognizes that the first and only solution to this, we've already commented on it, is faithfulness to God, is trust in God, the enemy of death, to be victorious. And so to accomplish that, to plant the seed of that trust and to nurture it and to grow it, God has given us absurdities by which to be saved. I'm saying this as a minister of the gospel, so please don't take it the wrong way. I'm not being sarcastic. The gospel is just downright silly from any human point of view. Paul says it's folly. You believe in a crucified Christ. He's not a triumphant general. He's dead. At least for 3 days. There's something about Christianity that's a little bit absurd, isn't it? Isn't there something about Christianity when I say at the end of every sermon that these are the things that matter most, and if you believe them, you should come let us put you in a pool of water, and that will fix it? Paul likes to point to those things and say, God loves things you think are folly. God loves to take things that you see no value in and say, that is how you'll put your trust in me. It's the kind of thing you wouldn't do by accident. It's the kind of thing you wouldn't do if you're trusting in your own method to solve the problem. God doesn't even banish death. I mean, wouldn't that have been an option, I suppose, when you think about it? God wants to triumph over death, and so he sends his son, and he says, my son is Superman without the kryptonite. My son is Superman without the kryptonite, and you can't kill him. And the Romans come and arrest him, and he just bats them away like a gnat. And they go and take him to a cross, and he says, do your worst, and they can't touch him. And they inflict pain on him, and he feels none of it. And that'd be a pretty good story. Marvel would make that into a comic book. I'd watch that movie. Jesus the Superman. That's not actually what God does. He doesn't send a Superman. He sends us man. He sends us Jesus. And when they try to kill him, you know what happens to him? He dies. When they inflict pain on him, he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because it hurts. God doesn't banish death. God sends his son to die like every one of us and triumphs through it. He overcomes all evil because of it. In precisely the greatest fear of humanity, God pulls out our greatest victory and shows us another way forward. A good news about death. For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. And folks, that's all you're going to get. In verse 22, for Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. Typically, we're not really satisfied with that answer. We would like something better. We're still waiting for Superman. We'd like something that would kind of make all this go away. We'd like for God to tell us you don't have to die, or something like that. That would be nice. The Jewish people say, give us a sign. They ask Jesus for a sign through four Gospels. Even after he does signs, they ask for signs. The Greeks say, give us a philosophy. Give us a human wisdom, a trick, a rhetorical device to get us out of the problem of death. And Paul says, every time we look to God and say, yeah, give us something else, he just keeps giving us the cross of Jesus Christ. That is his sign. That is his philosophy. That is his wisdom and his triumph over all evil. In all things, he points to the cross so that we can learn to be utterly and completely dependent on him. And all attempts to make the gospel something different, to turn it into a tool of compulsion or coercion, to make it something that forces people to recognize what it is and win that way, fail. Because that's not what it is. It's not that kind of sign. It's not that kind of philosophy. It is God saying, this is my answer. This is my power. This is my strength. This is the arm of the Lord revealed to you. This is the answer of death. I sent someone and he died and you did your worst to him. And I brought victory through that very cross. God isn't doing what we do with death. We want to escape it. God says, why would we do that when we can defeat it? And in the cross of Jesus Christ, he accomplishes precisely that. But we preach Christ crucified. Pause there. Can I just comment why he says it that way? It's remarkable. He doesn't say, we preach that Jesus was crucified, as if there's a man, Jesus, and he happens to have been crucified, like Ben Williams who's wearing a coat. It's not just a fact that happens to take place. He says, what we preach, the centerpiece of our doctrine, is the crucified Christ. It is not a blip on the radar. It is not a pit stop on his road to glory. It is the centerpiece of the message. There is no message without it. It's not a footnote to the story of Christ. Christ crucified is who we preach, because it is by the crucified Christ that God has given us victory. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews, folly to the Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. That's a cryptic little verse to end with, and if we didn't have a paragraph before it, it would make no sense whatsoever. I mean, quite literally, it reads something like, the dumbness of God is smarter than you. That doesn't even make any sense, right? But in the context, what Paul is saying is, God has taken precisely what you take foolish, precisely what you seem to deem weak, and he has made it strongest of all. Unlike every philosophy and escapist ideal of human life and culture, God is not trying to get us to avoid death. God is actually teaching us how to die and then how to live. You see how it's backwards, by the way? Every human philosophy, let me end with this, every human philosophy tells you how to live until inevitably you die. The gospel teaches us how to die so that at last we can begin to live. And we enact that with that perfectly absurd and foolish act I described a moment ago called baptism. There's a reason we have a pool of water up here. Because it is a way for us to put our trust in God, the answer of a good conscience toward God that says, yes, I believe in what you've done in your Son Jesus Christ, and that the cross is not foolishness, it is the greatest wisdom of all. And we partake in it. When we're lowered into it, we die. We die to begin to be something new, to walk in a newness of life, triumphing over death as a resurrected person like Jesus Christ, his Son. What is the wisdom of death? Stop trying to live your life trying to avoid that inevitable moment when you die. Instead, put to death the man of sin that has harmed you from the beginning and begin to live a life alive to God, and his son, Jesus Christ. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If we can do anything to help you with that, watch you come.